We're looking at the work of reporting COVID-19 infections and deaths and how these numbers come together in the mini charts and dashboards we see all over the internet. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The goal of public health officials is to see the number of newly reported cases and deaths fall over time. But when you have a situation where a person dies of multiple causes, how does that get reported? And then how does it affect the overall death tally for COVID-19? Bring your questions about reporting and interpreting the pandemic data at 800-642-1234. Will Cushman is associate editor at WisconText. That is the multimedia news and information project of WPR and PBS Wisconsin. And he's created data visualizations on COVID-19 in Wisconsin since the start of April. Will, welcome back.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So talking about the true COVID-19 death toll number has a whole lot of nuance to it and complexity. What can you tell us about the death toll and how deadly the coronavirus is?
You're right. There is a lot of nuance in there that I think sometimes gets lost. So maybe we can just start with the overall statistics as they're being reported by the state of Wisconsin right now. So we know that since March 19th, which was when Wisconsin announced its two first confirmed deaths from COVID-19, there have been 719 deaths confirmed from COVID-19 in the state. And that's out of 23,876 cases that have been confirmed in the state. So that right there is a death toll of about 3%. But that's 3% of known cases. So as we'll talk about over the next few minutes, that's really providing kind of an incomplete picture of the disease's toll.
Yeah, how is it incomplete when you look at those numbers?
Sure. It's incomplete in two ways. The first, probably more significant way, is that we have an incomplete understanding of how many infections there have been in the state. So that understanding is getting better as the state has expanded testing. The Department of Health Services is now reporting around roughly on any given day 10,000 test results every day. But back earlier in the pandemic, so in late March and the first part of April, the state was only reporting maybe a few hundred up to 1,000 test results per day. And over that same period, we've seen a decline in the percent of tests that are coming back positive. And so that can be an indication that the state is finding more of the infections that are occurring all across the state. That was probably not the case, or most definitely not the case at the beginning of the outbreak in March.
And as you get more and more people tested, ultimately, as those numbers go up and up and up on testing, that will too play into how the infection rate is, because you would naturally be having a broader net, if you will, for testing and finding more infection.
Exactly. Yeah. And we would, it's expected that the death rate as we understand it, so the number of confirmed deaths as compared to the number of confirmed infections is called the case fatality rate. So that's the fatality rate among known cases. And we would expect that to go down as testing increases and includes more people who are not seriously ill. That's the other thing that has changed quite dramatically since the beginning of the outbreak. Most people who were getting tested in the first several weeks that testing was available in Wisconsin were those who were hospitalized for the disease. So they were people who were already suffering severe symptoms from the disease and therefore were probably more likely to die anyway. So testing is now capturing a lot of people with mild symptoms, and even in some cases, people who are asymptomatic.
Will Cushman is associate editor of WisconText. We're talking about what the true death toll is from the pandemic, why reporting is nuanced and tricky. Are you confused about the stats on COVID-19 reporting? What questions do you have about how the data are compiled and presented? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Well, there are claims circulating that the COVID-19 death rate without a vaccine is lower than the flu death rate with a vaccine. And earlier this week, Raymond in Milwaukee called in with this question.
Since the seasonal flu is far more deadly, why aren't we shutting everything down every year for that? This seems totally blown out of proportion.
What can you tell us about comparisons with the flu?
Yeah, I think that public health officials kind of at the beginning of our understanding of novel coronavirus were making comparisons to the flu kind of to help the public understand the relative risk at the time. So that would have been in like January or February when the novel coronavirus was not really circulating in the US. And I think public health officials wanted to remind everyone that we were experiencing an ongoing flu season, and the flu does kill people. But I think that comparison has kind of turned into a bit of a faulty premise. A, because the diseases are so different. They both cause respiratory symptoms, but we're finding out that COVID also can affect all sorts of symptoms in the body and can cause really pretty wild inflammatory responses. It can cause blood clots that can be deadly. We're seeing strokes in younger people. So I really think that comparing the two diseases is tough. But we do know that the seasonal flu has a death rate, usually typical seasonal flu has a death rate of about 0.1%. And as I said earlier, the official death rate for COVID in Wisconsin right now is 3%. Epidemiologists and health demographers and doctors are all quite sure that that is quite high, that the true death rate is quite a bit lower, perhaps an order of magnitude lower. But the best estimates are still that the true overall death rate across the population from COVID-19 is about maybe 0.2% up to maybe 1%. That's getting pretty high. But even at its low end, it's still twice. Our best understanding right now is that it's twice as deadly as the seasonal flu. But that's the seasonal flu. Sometimes the strains of flu can be more deadly. The 1918 Spanish flu had a death rate of about 2%. That's kind of where those comparisons stand.
Well, let's take a call. Jim is with us from Slinger. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, and you'll notice that number, by the way, is continually falling. But I wanted to mention that I don't see any reporting on the bed count or the people in the ICU in Wisconsin. I follow that rate every day, and I see that it's been dropping. And nowhere in the news do they report that. I just heard your newscast at the top of the hour, and it talked about death, and it talked about the rate of testing. But it does not mention that the cases are actually dwindling in Wisconsin.
Jim, I'm going to pause there to let Will jump in because we're short here on time before the break. But do we have firm numbers on hospital bed capacity and the number of people in ICU units?
The caller is right that the state does track those numbers, and the Wisconsin Hospital Association also tracks those numbers. I'm not positive what they are right now. I know that we're going to be looking into hospitalizations going forward at WisConText for sure.
We're talking with Will Cushman from WisConText about the tracking and data reporting on the coronavirus. What do you want to know about the methodologies and systems for reporting COVID-19 deaths? What chart or numbers are you watching? Are you watching hospital beds and ICU? Do you still follow the gating criteria that the state put together in its original reopening plan? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Will Cushman on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how to measure how deadly the coronavirus is and what goes into a probable or confirmed case of COVID-19 for the purposes of tallying the death total. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has guidance for the death certificate reporting. It says COVID-19 can be listed as the immediate cause of death, the underlying cause, or a contributing factor. So what questions do you have about how Wisconsin is tracking mortality? What numbers do you follow to make decisions in your own life? Join in 800-642-1234. Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisconText, and he stays with us. Let's take another call now. Tara is with us from Stevens Point. Hi, Tara.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering why the website doesn't track how many people currently have coronavirus and how many people are getting coronavirus per day within each county as well as the state. Because I feel like how many people currently have coronavirus, like how many people haven't recovered yet, is very important to me for planning what I'm going to do.
Will, what about that tracking?
That's a really good question. And the state does track that. I think the caller may be asking about our data visualization page on WisConText. And we actually do have plans we're working on some reporting right now about what it really means to be recovered from COVID-19, both kind of individually, so anecdotally, but then what that means in the official state data, like how they consider someone to be a recovered case. And I do think the caller is right that as time goes by, the number of currently active cases versus recovered cases in any given area is going to become more important and more relevant. We know that right now, actually, for instance, in La Crosse County, which is dealing with quite a spike in cases just in the last week, the majority of the cases that have been reported in La Crosse County since the beginning of the pandemic, so since March, are active right now, versus there are other parts of the state where the majority of cases that have been reported over that same time period have now recovered. So the caller is definitely right that there's that can affect your risk depending on where you are and how active the disease is circulating in that community.
Will, is there set criteria that the state uses to establish what is a recovered case?
You know, they do have criteria, it's actually a colleague of mine who is working on that reporting right now. So I guess all I can say right now is stay tuned for that reporting.
Yeah.
But also the Department of Health Services has a lot of really useful information about how they report cases, confirmed cases, probable cases, confirmed deaths and probable deaths, and then the recovery status of a patient. If you just conduct an internet search for Wisconsin DHS outbreaks, that'll take you to the Department of Health Services outbreaks page, which will lead you to a whole number of really useful pages all devoted to understanding COVID-19.
Yeah, the Department of Health Services website is a deep dive into COVID. There is a lot of data there.
So much.
Cindy from Mount Horeb called in to tell us that the DHS website has hospital capacity information by region on it. So Cindy commenting there. Will, you know, the issue of how deaths are recorded is not only an issue here in Wisconsin, but all over, because, you know, the attending physician is involved, medical examiners, coroners, sometimes the funeral home is involved, public health officials. What goes into stating the standard for what goes on the death certificate and how the person perished?
That's a really good question. And a lot of times, at least from the people I've spoken to in Wisconsin, it sounds like it really depends on where the death occurs. So if the death occurs in a hospital or another healthcare setting or a nursing home, an attending physician will usually make the judgment call on whether or not to attribute that death to COVID-19. Most of the time, that judgment is made on the basis of a test result. So usually the test for the virus that causes COVID-19 is pretty good. And so most of the time that can be relied upon, like a positive test result can be relied upon as indicating that the death was likely caused by COVID-19. But that's not always the case. I actually talked to an emergency room physician at Bellin Hospital in Green Bay, who he said that he didn't treat this patient, but this was a couple of weeks ago, so they may have had more patients die from COVID in the meantime. But at the time that they had, at that time, he said that they had six patients who had died from COVID-19, and one of them, they actually tested multiple times, and the tests repeatedly came back negative. But they also conducted CT scans of the patient's chest and lungs and identified what he described as really classic signs of COVID-19 pneumonia, which has some really kind of classic signs that are unique to COVID-19. So he said that they could feel very confident about determining that patient died from COVID-19, even though they didn't have a positive test result.
Yeah, interesting. Multiple positive test results come back negative, but the CT scan, you can see the effect of COVID-19.
Exactly. Yeah, the symptom is called ground glass opacities. It's just the way that COVID-19 pneumonia appears in a CT scan. It's very classic and unique to the disease. But he said that, yeah, sometimes those swabs, those nasopharyngeal swabs that they take to do the testing, that's when they stick these long swabs up the patient's nose, and it can be quite uncomfortable. But he said that sometimes they're just not effective at getting any of the virus particles that may be in the patient's respiratory system. So sometimes a patient will test negative multiple times, even if they are quite positive they have the disease.
Talking with Will Cushman, Associate Editor at WisconText, we're talking about the metrics behind reporting and tracking COVID-19 in Wisconsin with your questions, 800-642-1234. Will, you know, in reporting this data and reporting deaths, a lot has to do with uniformity across different areas of Wisconsin, across states, even across countries. How consistent is the reporting that, local communities are doing here in Wisconsin? Do you see that the data is coming from very set standards from DHS?
You know, I know that there are definitely concerns about the consistency of reporting data. And I actually talked to a medical examiner in Racine County who said that he actually was potentially more worried about COVID deaths being overcounted than undercounted because of kind of the intricacies in reporting. He said, he shared an anecdote where there was a resident of Racine County who sought treatment for COVID-19 in Kenosha County, subsequently died. And the medical examiner in Racine County was notified, as was the one in Kenosha County, and then therefore the local health departments are also notified. And so he's only aware of that part of the process. And so being aware of only that part of the process, he said it kind of led him to be a little bit concerned that maybe both counties would report that death as occurring and maybe double counting that death. I did talk to representatives at the Department of Health Services specifically about that case and about that broader issue in general. And they said that they work on a daily basis with local health departments to confirm whatever cases and deaths are reported to them. And you can see that the data does get updated pretty much on a daily basis, where like you can see that they are correcting some data. So it's never going to be 100% perfect, but I think I'm confident as a reporter that the data that we're getting from the state is well vetted.
No peer data. You spend a lot of time with this data. Where are the trend lines going that you can see? Can we see trends right now in Wisconsin?
You know, the trend in Wisconsin has been fairly steady lately, about anywhere from a couple to maybe about 10 deaths per day over the last couple weeks. New cases have been in the couple hundreds per day. Yesterday, it was a little bit higher, it was over 400. But the test positivity, so the number of tests that are coming back positive, which is also a really important indicator of where the state is controlling the outbreak, that's been steadily going down from about 10% to lately, the last couple of weeks, it's been about 2 to 3%. It did tick up yesterday to 4%, but we'll see where it goes.
Will, thank you for joining us and for your reporting.
Thanks so much, Kate.
Will Cushman is associate editor at WisConText. You can find his reporting and a whole bunch of charts, graphs, interviews at wisconText.org. Coming up, Wisconsin's pro athletes are marching. They're responding to demonstrations in the wake of George Floyd's death. We discuss their calls for change and plans to restart league play. Are you a Bucks, Brewers, or Packers fan? How do you feel about the league's suspending their seasons? What do you think of the NBA's plan for restarting play at Disney in Orlando? Join in 800-642-1234. That's after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's pro athletes are responding to demonstrations in the wake of George Floyd's death. We're looking at their calls for change and plans to restart league play. Earlier this month, the Packers released a video they called Enough is Enough. It's Aaron Rodgers and 11 of his teammates looking directly into their cameras. Here's some player sentiment.
People who look like me should not be afraid around law enforcement.
I'm a human, just like all of you. My blood is red. My heart pumps that blood. I'm a human, too.
How is the pro athlete you admire responding to the protests and failures to deal with racism on and off the field? How have your favorite sports been affected by the pandemic? When and how should play resume? We're at 800-642-1234. Olivia Reiner is a sports multimedia reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers the Packers, Brewers, and Bucks. Olivia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited and happy to be here with you this morning, Kate.
How are professional athletes here in Wisconsin responding to the death of George Floyd?
They are responding very publicly. I think social media has really changed the way that any of us can respond to any topic, and plenty of the Packers, the Brewers, and the Bucks have been taking to social media to spread their thoughts, taking to Twitter, to Instagram, and I think it's been really interesting to watch it all happen. I think one of the more interesting people on the Packers team that I've gotten to talk to over the last couple weeks following the death of George Floyd is Packers right guard Billy Turner. He and I had a conversation just a couple weeks ago, and he's been really active on social media and sending out the messages similar to the one that we all just heard right now in the Packers video. He's been trying to make a statement over the last couple weeks with his teammates.
There are these videos from teams and from leagues circulating on the internet addressing racism and the protests. What do you think of these presentations?
I think they're a good first step. I mean, it's good to put the message out there and for the teams to show how they feel or how they want to operate going forward. However, they're just words. Until they're able to put some action behind those words, they can only be taken as words. And that goes for any organization that's put out any statement across the country. There has to be some action to back that up. And that is going to take some time and some thought and some meetings. Hearing from head coach of the Packers, Matt LaFleur, he's talked about meeting with his assistant coaches and discussing what an action plan might look like, things that can be done immediately going forward to make the Packers start to dismantle aspects of systemic racism in this country, whether it's making sure all the players are registered to vote. And hopefully we'll get to see exactly what that vision looks like going forward, but there needs to be action behind those words.
Yeah. Is there any timeline that you've heard for these action steps to get off the ground?
At the team level, there hasn't been much of an indication as to exactly what that list or when those actions will be put in place. We know the Packers have said that they're dedicated to donating $250,000 to organizations in an effort to combat systemic racism. We know that Packers CEO and President Mark Murphy is going to be matching that donation with his own money. But besides that, that's really all we know in terms of the action. And we know also that there's certain players, like I mentioned, Turner's a player that does his own philanthropic efforts. He's from the Minneapolis area. And after speaking with him, he's working on some plans himself to start doing something on an individual level to give back to his community in Minneapolis. However, when it comes to the organizations, we haven't exactly seen what those steps are going to be besides the monetary donation.
Switching gears here to the Brewers, how have the Brewers responded to the demonstrations against police brutality and the calls for change?
They've released their own team statement, and there have been individual players taking to social media to also talk about what's going on in the world. But besides that, unfortunately, the talk of the MLB recently hasn't really been focused on not only police brutality or the death of George Floyd or even the coronavirus, but it's really been focused on negotiations between the owners and the Players Association when it comes to figuring out when and how the season will restart. And the negotiations have been going on for quite literally months now. And every day there's new news about essentially what the owners and the players disagree on. They have agreed to disagree on just about everything. And unfortunately, that has taken over the narrative of this season.
Olivia Reiner with us, a sports multimedia reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about the era of sports right now and how teams are responding amid the pandemic and the systemic racism and the death of George Floyd. You can call in with your insights on what sports you're thinking about right now, how your sports are affected, 800-642-1234. So, Olivia, the Bucks organized a march in Milwaukee about 2 weeks ago. What did you see and hear during that march?
Yeah, so the Bucks were out there being led by players like Giannis Antetokounmpo, as well as forward Sterling Brown, who has had his own run-in with the police in the past. He was arrested outside of a convenience store or a drugstore last year. And they have been standing in solidarity with the protesters, which has been it's been an interesting thing to see. And they're not the only professional athletes that have been going out and protesting and calling for change. Even certain players across the league, especially like Brooklyn Nets guard Kyrie Irving, has been raising the question, should NBA be returning to play in light of the bigger social justice issues that need to be addressed in this country? Is going back and starting up the season again the right thing to do when there are bigger issues at hand? And we've seen WNBA players take some time away from the game and deciding to take away their time from playing in the league right now when it restarts. Like in the past, Maya Moore, for example, has taken a break and said, hey, we need to focus on other things. So there's discussions are also happening at the same time while certain players are deciding to protest and just support their other teammates in whatever decision they decide to make as to whether or not they want to play this upcoming season.
So it seems like the NBA, though, is pretty deep into a plan for restarting next month in Orlando. What does that look like?
So right now, all of the dates are tentative in theory. However, they do have more of a concrete plan than, say, the MLB does, which I suppose isn't saying very much. However, they do have the tentative training camp start date as June 30th. And then teams would actually head out to Orlando to play in what they're calling a bubble. So all of the upcoming games in the NBA season, the rest of the NBA season, is going to take place in Orlando. The teams would head out there July 7th, and then the season would supposed to start on July 31st. So they would play about eight seeding games, and then they would play the rest of a normal playoff schedule. And that would all happen at Orlando at Disney World at ESPN's Wide World of Sports. They have three courts down there, and they play all the games spread out over the next few months. So it's certainly, it's a plan. They have a plan. They have some health protocols in place. But there are certainly still some questions and some things to keep an eye on going forward.
Well, how do the Bucks fare here? Because, you know, going to do eight regular season games and then before playoffs and then, you know, to the playoffs, what could the Bucks have to gain or lose in these games?
Well, the Bucks were doing really well when all of this stopped. So they had a league best record of 53-12 going into this stoppage. So if you're a team that's playing really well and you have a lot of momentum,
you're on a roll.
Sure, the last thing you want to do is stop. So it's certainly not ideal. However, this is going to be a big test of how strong that team is in just restarting and playing in this sort of unusual situation and being in kind of, they're all staying in hotels together. They're not really supposed to be bringing in guests, and there's no fans, obviously, that are going to be around to view the games in the stands. So they're going to have to band together and figure it out. However, they, like I said, they have a really good record. They're the best team in the league going into this. So they right now, based on the seeding, if they're able to hold their first overall spot, once they start the playoffs, they would be playing whoever the eighth seed is going to be. So it's it'll be similar, I suppose, in terms of the strength of the team that they're playing heading into the playoffs. However, it's just going to be a different environment, and we'll see how everything gets handled.
Yeah, what would this bubble be like? How is the league going to be able to prevent outbreaks?
That's a fantastic question. I'm not entirely sure. They say they're going to be testing players regularly. When the players arrive at Disney World, all of the players, everyone who gets there has to self-isolate in their hotel rooms for up to 48 hours until they have two negative coronavirus tests. So that's just to make sure that there's no one that is in this bubble that has the virus. And they're not allowed to go into each other's rooms. Each team has their own chef and food room. So that they're doing their best to try to keep these people separate when they're off the court. But at the end of the day, basketball is a contact sport. They can take as many precautions as they possibly can to try and minimize the spread of the virus. At the end of the day, I'm not entirely sure how effective that's going to be. We don't know what's going to happen if one player gets the virus, if five players get the virus, if 15, if, you know, we could keep adding up the numbers.
Olivia Reiner covers the Packers, Brewers, and Bucks for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're looking at the road ahead for pro sports during the pandemic. How do you feel about the NBA's plans for restarting league play? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the coronavirus spread around the world in recent months, we've watched tournaments and games, other sporting events all be canceled, like Wimbledon, Boston Marathon. Others have been postponed, Summer Olympics, Tour de France. The Major League Baseball Players Association has finalized a proposal for a season of 70 games. How do you see the Brewers looking? The NBA's Board of Governors approved, as we've been talking about, a proposal for 22 teams to return to play on July 31st in Orlando. How do you think the Bucks will do? We're at 800-642-1234. We have Olivia Reiner with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So, Olivia, you would think that the Bucks roster, they would be healthy and rested up after this time, the stay-at-home time. But what are the players looking like right now? Because they probably haven't been on the court.
Yeah, it's been difficult for them to get their typical exercise regimen in, as it is for any athlete at this point in time. They're just doing their best, which means that when they get back to Milwaukee on that tentative date, June 30th, they're going to have to capitalize on that time as much as humanly possible. But they're all at home hanging out with their families just like the rest of us are, which honestly has been kind of fun to keep an eye on social media to see what new father Giannis has been up to with his new son. He's very prolific on TikTok and has been posting lots with his son. So it's been kind of entertaining.
Proud dad.
But yeah, they've got a lot of work to do.
How is Giannis doing? How is he staying well? What can we tell?
Yeah, it looks like he is. It looks like he's healthy. He was doing pretty well heading into that break. The Bucks don't really have any major injury issues right now to be concerned about. No players that had season-ending injuries. So Giannis looks like he's doing well and looks like he's having a lot of fun with his son.
Which teams look like the Bucks' biggest obstacles to winning the Eastern Conference and advancing to the championship series?
I think it's a lot of the same teams that it's been in years past. The Toronto Raptors are not too far behind the Bucks in the Eastern Conference. The Boston Celtics are up there, and even the Philadelphia 76ers, all strong teams. But the Bucks have been the favorite this season, and for good reason. Like I said, league best 53-12 when play was suspended in March. So they have a 6.5 game lead over the Raptors right now. So there's a good chance that they can keep that top seeding in the Eastern Conference heading into the playoffs.
When you're looking at the Western Conference, what do you see there for teams to watch who might down the line play the Bucks in the finals?
I think really the Lakers could be the team. Maybe we see a little bit of Giannis and LeBron.
Oh my goodness.
In the finals this year, I think would be a lot of fun for Bucks fans and just NBA fans. I mean, what a matchup that would be for the NBA. I think after being deprived of sports for a really long time, having the NBA start back up and for the finals to be between the Bucks and the Lakers would be a really awesome matchup, but we'll see what
happens. Super satisfying. So let's switch gears here. What is happening in Major League Baseball's negotiations to restart the season? I mean, you mentioned earlier that they've been in the thick of this renegotiation. What does that look like between the players and the league, the coaches?
It's been a mess, honestly. I was just going back over sort of the timeline of everything that's happened over the last several months, and there is so much back and forth. It's almost like it would make a really great movie maybe one day, a great documentary one day, just to try to track all of this.
Don't worry, Olivia. ESPN is all over it. Multifaceted.
Great. I'm sure they are, and they should be, because it's intriguing, and there's a lot of drama here if you're into that sort of thing.
Where's the drama? You're right. What's going on behind closed doors?
The drama is that, like I said, the league, the owners and the players can't seem to agree on anything, and they can only agree on what they've disagreed on. And the crux of the issue kind of goes back to a meeting that they had a supposed agreement, I suppose. I guess it really was an agreement back on March 27th when the two sides reportedly came to an agreement as to how much money how many games that the league would play, that they would play this upcoming season, how much money they would be making and paying out to the players. The big issue, I think, in this is that the players want to make as much money as possible. They want to earn their entire prorated salaries. So that means they would be earning the normal amount of money that each player would be making per game. They want to continue to make 100% of that money. They understand that the season is going to be shortened at this point. However, they want to make the maximum amount of money. The league, on the other hand, the owners, they would like to save as much money as possible. So they would like to play, in theory, as few games as possible, and to be paying a discount each game to each player. So that's sort of where the sides are. It's very much rooted in money. We haven't really even gotten to the part that, oh yeah, we're in the middle of a pandemic and they're going to have to make sure that the protocols are in place and the guidelines are in place to keep the players safe. It's just been focused on the money so far.
Talking about the return of pro sports with Olivia Reiner from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers the Brewers and the Packers and the Bucks. Olivia, have any Brewers players been outspoken about concerns that they have with the pandemic and playing at this time?
Yeah, I think there have been some concerns about the pandemic. However, the concern, I think for the most part, the players would like to get back to the game. There is some concern about health and safety, but I feel like that has been, like I said, so far in the past at this point, where now the anger and the vitriol is being aimed toward the owners at not being able to come to any sort of agreement as to what this upcoming season is going to look like. And we've seen players like Christian Yelich pointing to a thread of tweets from Reds pitcher Trevor Bauer about how the league isn't operating, they're not negotiating in good faith right now. And there's, I think, again, all of the issues going on in this world, whether it's the coronavirus or whether it's the death of George Floyd and the subsequent protests, all of that has been overshadowed by these negotiations.
Well, circling back to where we started with the Packers and the NFL, what are their plans for play this fall?
So the plans right now seem to be business as usual, which in my mind is a little bit confusing again, because it can't be business as usual. There's no vaccine and the football is a highly contact sport. So there's going to be some issues when it comes to getting the season up and going again. Right now, I believe the tentative start date for training camp for the Packers would be July 28th. And then they would have their training camp. There's been some talks of having an abbreviated preseason and getting into the regular season a little bit quicker. However, there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion about, you know, yet about what the health protocols are going to be, what the testing protocols are going to be. I'm assuming that they are having those discussions. However, right now, it really does look like business as usual.
Well, looking at economic numbers, if the Packers don't allow fans into Lambeau, what could that mean for Green Bay's economy?
It's not great. It would hurt. The entire town really benefits from having visitors come to Lambeau Field, coming to Green Bay for a long weekend, a weekend, and staying at hotels and eating at restaurants and shopping in the community. That's a huge economic boost in Green Bay, and for that to not be a factor would really be devastating for the entire economy. It's really a shame, unfortunately, but it's certainly looking like that's the way it's headed.
Olivia, before we have to leave you, where do you focus your attention when so many sports are sidelined?
Man, I think there's always stories. There's always something going on. At the beginning of this pandemic, the focus was on the pandemic and talking to players about how this has impacted their preparation for the upcoming season when it comes to the NFL, especially, and talking to Packers players. And then after George Floyd's death and after a lot of the protests started happening, it was on, you know, how are you doing? What is the team doing? What conversations are you having with your teammates? The reality is that this world, the players live in it too. And what's going on in our daily lives impacts their lives too. They care about everything just as much as we do. So
Olivia,
it all is over interwoven.
Olivia, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I had a great time. I appreciate it.
Olivia Reiner, sports multimedia reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Just ahead, it's a WPR Explorers Club Hour with the members of the crazy awesome PBS series Odd Squad. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.